Hello and welcome to the Day Zero update for May 9th, 2015. I'm Filippo Gianfa.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm Lee Lamb.
And I'm Teresa Sammons.
Hello, iTunes.
Yeah, we're now officially on iTunes, and I believe we're on a few other podcast aggregators. Check your favorite directory. We should show up now. If not, just leave a comment on the show page, and if we're not on there, we'll make sure to get on there.
Yeah, I think you forgot to add iTunes. We are in you.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to hear back from Xbox, so we'll hopefully be on there for fairly soon.
Hello,
too.
Hello, disembodied ghost of Steve Jobs.
too soon.
God damn it.
And we're off to a great start this week.
And we're off iTunes.
Sorry.
Why did a prime example of how we can't have nice things.
Yep. I'm sorry, but why do we kill the things we love?
Is it in our nature? This
isn't exactly the usual form of gaming podcast.
being that this is the first time a lot of you will be hearing us, we figured we'd take a moment before we get the show started in earnest to kind of introduce the concept of our show, what we do, how we kind of set ourselves apart from other podcasts, and why we call ourselves the Day Zero Update.
Yeah, the reason behind that is basically that lately the trend in game development has been ship it and then patch it immediately. So, hence the Day Zero update, where you plop in your game and then you have to wait for a 4 GB download to finish before you can play it.
It's in our nature to lampoon the things that annoy us, and this is one that was worthy of forever enshrining in our show name. So we ourselves are supportive of the mentality of delays are temporary, mediocrity is forever.
Yep.
And that tends to fly in the face of a lot of things that go on in the industry these days.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, there are still some big developers out there that do adhere to that philosophy. Rockstar comes to mind.
That's true, and we certainly appreciate it when it happens.
Yeah. And we're not, anti-AAA or anything. We're just kind of old and crotchety old folks.
The entire show is fueled by what you might call host appeal or presenter appeal. Rather than regurgitating AAA hype that you can find pretty much anywhere else, we'd rather talk about the things that actually have us engaged with the industry, and we'd like to be the podcast that, rather than informing you about things you already know, we want you guys to discover games because of us. We all have kind of our choice franchises, our choice games, and over time you'll find that we're very vocal about that, and hopefully, through this podcast, you can find your way to some games that you might not have otherwise found.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're also incredibly good looking.
Yeah. Yes. Maybe, when we get the video version of the show, people will be able to see that. But for now, you'll just have to use your imagination. before I forget though, I did want to give a quick shout out to, my friend James, who hooked us up with the cover art for the show.
It looks fantastic.
Yeah, we wanted to do it as kind of a throwback to the 90s style of album covers, so we figured lightning bolts and scan lines and texture, basically everything that flies in the face of what is considered modern design. Yeah, we're doing that.
Also very indicative of the show as a whole.
Yeah. So, thanks again, James. It's much appreciated. So let's jump into what we're playing.
For my part, I have to preface this by saying this has been a really weird week for me, and it's only going to get weirder because my work schedule is in a bit of a transition right now. I'm shifting to some new days off, and so that means working more days in a row than I normally do, or just getting one day off and having my days off split up to compensate. Once I come out the other side of that, it'll be fantastic because I'll have Thursdays and Fridays off, which will be very good for my gaming. But in the interim, it's kind of limited me to the mobile side of things. Thankfully, Square Enix has been on the case. I'm still loving the hell out of Final Fantasy Record Keeper. Just this morning, they dropped the sort of a preliminary Final Fantasy VIII content. It's the Delling City arc, and you can recruit Rinoa, which I've already done this morning. And then after that, there's a whole elite set of battles that you can go through after that to get, you know, more loot and stuff. And I'm actually back on Final Fantasy Dimensions, which I can't understate the quality of enough. People who are put off by Final Fantasy 10 or 12 or 13, anything made in the last 15, 16 years of the franchise, look no further than Final Fantasy Dimensions because it is a proper follow-up from, you know, the Super NES and PlayStation years. It's on iOS. It's on Android. Prices have come down for it. But, you know, back on iOS, I paid the full, I think it was $30 for it, and I have no regrets.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, it's fantastic. I'm glad you're playing that again.
Yeah, I love it. And now that I have it on my phone, I mean, I was playing the hell out of it when I had it on my iPad 3. Now it's in my pocket, and just one of the best RPGs Square Enix has dropped in the last several years.
Yeah, and you got a large screen phone too, so it's
not like, Note 3.
Yeah, it's not like it's hard to play.
Yeah. How about you? What have you been up to?
Same old. Defense Grid 2, I managed to play a lot of. Mortal Kombat 10 has been taking up most of my gaming time this week. I can't stress enough how good this game is. Yeah, I've got opened up everything in the crypt right now, so now I'm just going through and getting all of the unlockables that I didn't have money for at the time.
Nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's that. I also played a little bit of Dirt Rally, which I didn't put on the lineup. Yeah, that game's good.
Are you liking it?
It's really good.
Yeah. So there's a good number of rally games out there at this point. Would you compare it to a Sega Rally, a Colin McRae, past Dirt titles? What? Where exactly would you put Dirt Rally in the scope of those?
It's more realistic than the past Dirt titles have been, and there's a lot more to it than, you know, Dirt 2 or Dirt 3. For example, the races tend to be longer, which is good because some of the races in Dirt 2 and Dirt 3 were only like 2 minutes long, and so wasn't very satisfying. Physics wise, I think it's far more realistic than the Dirt games have been. It's not quite as realistic as, say, Richard Burns Rally used to be, but it's not far off.
That is obscure.
Yeah. So it's, you know, if you're a rally fan who's like been kind of left out in the cold for the past few years looking for something good, this is definitely one that you want to check out.
Cool.
What about you, Brandon?
Sunset Overdrive. My verdict is it's a lot of fun, but boy, is it stupid. I mean, the fake hipness is so strong and so clear that it can be really painful at times.
No, it had the stench of that coming off the very first trailer at E3, like 2013. What? Yeah.
Well, I thought that they had intended it to be kind of a comedy type game.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Okay.
And I will admit, it actually is funny in parts, but it's funny the way a really dumb show on the Cartoon Network is funny.
Yeah. It's basically turn your brain off at the door and just have fun.
Yeah. But it really is genuinely fun, though. The whole sort of bouncing and grinding aspect to the they've got to it is really good and really addictive. Let's see. Other than that, I've also been playing The Last of Us because it's The Last of Us.
Yeah.
You're a braver
person. Do I need this? You haven't played it?
No, I would never sleep. I'm a giant chicken, you guys. I really am.
Yeah. The game's about a year old now. That opening, man.
Yeah, we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, that opening will just wreck you for the whole week.
Yeah.
But, you know, The Last of Us, I think, may be the first example of a AAA, fully holistic gaming experience where everything about this game, the visuals, the story, the music, the gameplay, everything is meant to emphasize this theme of desolation and loneliness and despair. It's got some of the most brutal combat I've ever experienced in a game. Like everything, you know, every punch, every gunshot, every whack of a, you know, a pipe or a crowbar or whatever is just, you can feel it.
Yeah.
It's meant to imply just how violent every possible attack is.
Yeah.
And honestly, and to be perfectly honest, combat is actually kind of a small part of the overall gaming experience. A lot of, because the thing is, ammo is so scarce in this game. And
well, survival horror.
Yeah. And a lot of it is just trying to, is kind of stealth oriented and just trying to avoid those, you know, for lack of a better word, zombies. But the thing is, though, the thing about this, though, is that Naughty Dog came up with a really brilliant idea in that instead of making the zombie apocalypse based on something like a virus or, you know, a chemical spill or, you know, just hell filling up and the dead walking the earth, they actually just decided to base it on something that actually exists in nature, which are called cordyceps. Cordyceps are a type of fungus that are found in jungles, and they specifically target insects. In fact, there's thousands of varieties of cordyceps, and all of them specialize in different species of insects. And what they do is they act like a fungus. So when the spores hit a particular insect, it then basically takes over the brain of that insect, and it'll make it like climb up to high places and stalks, and then when the insect dies, it starts growing these fungal stalks out of the back of the head, which then spreads more spores to other various insects.
I think I read about this somewhere.
Yeah.
It wasn't recently. But
the idea with The Last of Us is that at some point...
Oh, shit, they got Brandon.
Uh-oh. Well, that's a big pile of nope to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's high-octane nightmare fuel rooted in reality.
Yep. There's actually worst. If you ever get the chance, there's an interesting thing they did about it. The BBC did about them. There's a clip on it on YouTube, and it's just about as terrifying as you'd expect it would be. And remember, this isn't fantasy. This is a real, actual, honest to God thing that exists.
Now you can wind up with that YouTube video from Brazil of I don't know if you've seen this, but where it was raining spiders.
Yeah.
Like what happened was there was some
there was like a tornado
windstorm in Brazil that pretty much sucked these huge spider webs out of trees, and the spiders didn't have anything to do but go down.
Yep.
Okay, this stuff's only supposed to happen in Australia.
Well, I mean, you know, the same thing happens like here in the States. You know, you'll have tornadoes and then suddenly it will just start raining fish.
What can I say? Brazil's fucking metal.
Yeah. But also, other than that, thanks to some emulators I've gotten, I've downloaded, I am playing both Snatcher and Police Knots. Those are two early visual novel / adventure games by none other than Mr. Hideo Kojima.
Timely.
Yeah.
Yes. Snatcher is genuinely is a really good visual novel / adventure game.
Yeah, it still plays really well. I played it a few years back on my I emulated it on my PSP, and I was actually surprised. The gun sections are a little wonky, but I was surprised at how well the rest of it held up.
Yeah, and the thing is, you realize really quickly, you know, Kojima became famous with Metal Gear Solid for all of the cinematic visuals and the movie references and everything. Yeah, that's something he's been doing since the very beginning of his career, because Snatcher came out right around the time that the first Metal Gear game debuted. And it even the opening of the game, cinematic of the game, is almost a direct lift from the opening of Blade Runner. Like, it's got the fire coming out of the smokestacks, it's got the pyramid, everything. The ships and flying cars and stuff going in and out of the screen. Really, the game really is, it is a giant pastiche of Blade Runner and Terminator. But it's also really good. It's got some great characters in it, great artwork, some fantastic sprite-based artwork. Like, Lee can back me up on this. The graphics look amazing.
Yeah, they do.
For a game this old.
It's great.
It's loaded with a lot of... It's got a lot of, like... one of the neat things about it, it's got sort of like a... some like extra like fictional documents and entries on computers and stuff that helps flesh out the universe that it's taking place in. There's this one part where you're going into this club because you're trying to interview this dancer who works at the club. And the club, it's basically all the patrons are, you know, it's Snake and Simon Belmont and the dudes from Contra and the Penguin from Penguin Adventure.
That sounds surreal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great game. It is a lot of fun. Of course, being a visual novel and at its heart a murder mystery, obviously there's a lot of dialogue trees and stuff you have to go through. But it's a genuinely compelling game. Like he mentioned, though, the shooting segments do kind of break up the sort of bring some action into it every so often, but they can be kind of wonky because it's done on a grid pattern. And but other than that, also its spiritual successor, which is Police Knots. And Police Knots basically plays a lot like Snatcher. Big difference is that unlike Snatcher, Police Knots has full motion anime sequences in it. As a matter of fact,
popular around that time.
Yeah. How many of you guys have played Metal Gear Solid?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All of you have played Metal Gear Solid?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember the part where you first talked to Otacon, and Otacon is describing why he got into robotics, and he said it was because of Japanese anime, and then you start seeing those anime cutscenes that start showing up?
Yeah.
Those are from Police Knots.
Oh. Very Kojima.
Yeah.
Yeah. Police Knots, you can basically say it's Lethal Weapon in space.
Wow.
Literally, the main character is basically Mel Gibson circa 1987. With the mullet and everything.
Oh my god.
Nice.
That was the era.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, it's mostly the basic idea is that it takes place right around the time when humanity has gotten into space colonization. And as with a lot of space colonization stories, Earth has sort of fallen by the wayside and all the wealth has gone off to the colonies. What is it that it's called, the sort of effect that it has on time and aging when you travel through space?
Relativity.
Yeah, the relativity. It's actually a big part of this story because the main character that you play as, at one point in the story, he goes off into space for a while, leaving his ex-girlfriend who's like in her 20s or something. And by the time the game starts, he hasn't aged very much, even though he's back on Earth. But his ex-girlfriend is like in her early 40s. And he meets up with his ex-partner, who, of course, is based on you-know-who. And he's like middle-aged, even though he only left like maybe 10 years ago.
You got to remember, he's getting too old for this shit.
Old for this shit.
Yeah. It's got some shooting segments, although unlike the grid-based segments in Snatcher, the ones at Police Knots are light gun-based. So it's a bit more, it's not as, you know, trapped within the grid space. Also, this is the first game where Meryl makes her appearance. Yes, the same Meryl who shows up in the Metal Gear games. This is where she first showed up. And
Kojima.
Yeah. They're both really good games. If you can get the proper emulators for them, I highly recommend them. If you're one of those people who just not only loves a good visual novel adventure game, but is just in love with Kojima's unique brand of cinematic weirdness, you've got to play it.
Yeah.
But that was me.
All right. Teresa, you're up.
All right. Well, I have, of course, been playing Civilization V, and Catherine the Great and the horse that she rode in on can go, you know what.
What happened?
You know, yeah. Yeah. About 10 hours into the game yesterday.
Oh my God.
I'm still a little cranky about that. Yeah, I was trying to do the Manhattan Project so I could bomb her ass into oblivion. I was a little late on that because Montezuma kept attacking me. Like, great. Used to be my ally. Like, twice we had a defensive pact with each other, and then his ass he just turned. So, yes.
Fuck that noise.
Yeah. So, been playing that. Still playing Pokemon Omega. So, working on that. I was, okay, I shouldn't admit this. I was battling. You know, my kid has Ruby. I have Sapphire. And, you know, I'm like, all right, I'll battle with you, whatever. You know, I didn't go back to the Pokemon Center. I just went with what I had in my team, which was
She kicked your ass, didn't she?
He wiped me out. 7 years old. Kicked my ass, and he still had Pokemon. Oh, the shame. The absolute shame. But I've also been playing Awesome Knots, and he is taking me down on the leaderboard really bad because he keeps playing. He doesn't have his own Steam account. He's seven. He doesn't have his own Steam account, mama. You know. And
circle of life.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually got into a pretty big fight over that. It's like, stop playing Awesome Knots online. You're killing me. So, yeah, that was part of World War III. Pat was privy to that conversation.
Yeah.
And then I started up Ease 2, so I've been playing that as well.
How are you liking that?
I'm liking it. I'm sitting here thinking, why am I playing Pokemon? I could be playing Ease.
Yeah.
So.
That soundtrack.
Oh, that soundtrack is awesome. It really is. It's some old school awesome, but I dig it.
Yeah.
Yuzo Koshiro.
Yep.
really good example of some of that early Falcom stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lee?
Well, just like every other week, I've been playing the Old Republic. They just did the 12 times XP, so you can basically level through the game through just story quests only.
12 times,
so,
oh my god!
Yeah, so well, because so the game really has two styles of questing. It has your class quest, which is your individual story, and then you have planetary quests where, you know, there's a quest line on the planet or multiple ones that kind of take you down the planet storyline. Yeah. The Old Republic kind of has an issue with that a lot of MMOs do. Like, once you get to like level 40, you're doing the same thing that you've done before. The Old Republic at least has the benefit of the story classes to kind of keep it interesting, because each of the stories is really unique. But basically what they did is, you know, MMOs tend to drop a lot of subs in the summertime. And so this is kind of their way to keep people subscribed and interested. And it's really good for people that play a lot of alts, because then you can go through, get them, you know, up to level 55 or 60 and try to do some of the end game content. And since they do 12 times the XP, basically you can skip around the planets that you have to go to and stuff like that, and really just level only doing your class quest. So you kind of get to see the stories without anything else. I don't know if it's a good way. I don't really think it's a good way to play the game if it's the first thing that you're doing, particularly on the Imperial side. I think the first two planets for the Imperials are really, really strong. The stories are really cool. But once you start kind of having everybody intersect, like, you know, everybody goes to a planet called Nar Shaddaa, which is the Hutt planet. I feel like stuff kind of homogenizes at that point. So then you can just do your class quests and get leveled up and see the story. So I've been enjoying that. There's actually been some twists and turns that I wasn't expecting for some of my characters. And what I've actually been doing, I've been playing that with my wife. But when I don't play that, I actually recently got a modified OG Game Boy Advance. And I got it with the screen from the AGS 101 model of the Game Boy Advance SP. So it's the LCD, kind of like what's in the DS.
Wow.
And
the backlit proper.
Yeah. And I have an SP. I have a backlit SP, and I even have a DS, but there's something about the form factor of the original GBA that's just really, really awesome. And I've got so many games that I never got around to playing, so I've been kind of dabbling with that stuff. But the biggest one that I went back to is Final Fantasy VI Advance. Final Fantasy VI is my favorite game of all time. I probably replay it once a year. And because my Super Nintendo and everything is put away, I've mainly been playing it on my GBA. And big problem with the GBA version is the music is really, really compromised. Compared to the Super Nintendo soundtrack, it's just shrill and it's awful, and I don't know why they did that, but whatever. There's actually a ROM hack out there that restores the original music, and I have a flash cart because my kid plays my GBA a lot. Yeah. And even though I've got two copies of Final Fantasy VI, because I bought one like to save it. Like, this is my favorite game of all time. I have to have more than one.
I know that feeling.
But like, I have the copy that I play, and I have the copy that's in my closet in the seal. I should probably sell that right now, considering how much some of that stuff's worth. But anyway,
what's it going for? You know,
I think it's at least over $100. Jesus. So, but I'll wait until like, because you know people are like still grabbing up all this retro stuff now. That seems to be the thing. But yeah, this hack, oh my god, it's like, it's almost kind of like discovering the game new again, because the music in VI is so good. Like, music in Final Fantasy in general is fantastic, but the music in VI is particularly with the way that they work it around the scenarios that you're in, I feel is more important than music in a lot of other RPGs. The tone that it sets is really fantastic. So to be able to get the original music back, but to have the better translation of the GBA and everything else, oh my god, I'm in heaven. I don't even want to play anything. I haven't played anything new. Probably not going to play anything new for another week or two just because of it. It's, oh my god, it's so good. It's so good. And the other thing too, since I had that flashcard, I've been able to start messing with the English translation of Mother 3. Which is super, super. I jumped through some hoops to actually get it loaded on my flashcard, but it is it's a lot of fun. Because I just got done. I just finished Earthbound a couple of months ago after revisiting it when it came out on the Virtual Console. So it's always been a shame to me that a game like Earthbound in that style really hasn't been revisited too often, because it really is unique. And even when you see like Ness in Smash Brothers, my son doesn't know who that is. So when he sees me playing Earthbound and then he goes and does Smash, he's like, oh, that makes sense now. And it would be so – I wish they could do another game. Like just old school, do it like 2.5D if you have to. Just make a game like that, you know? You would think with this indie revival we'd see something, but God, it's so good too. The translation is fantastic. The guy that did it is just – yeah. So I'm on a retro kick. I'll probably be on a retro kick for a while.
That's easy to have happen.
Yeah.
Good. Now want to go back and play Earthbound. I really want that now.
So my question, having played, some of Mother 3, is it as criminal as people let on that Nintendo hasn't brought it to North America?
Yeah, it definitely is criminal that they haven't brought it to North America. I mean, obviously, you know, we've talked previously on the podcast. I know other people may have not heard it, but you know, we had mentioned how it seemed like they didn't really know there was that pent up demand, even though to everybody that's American and can read American websites, they're like, oh my God, this is something that's totally wanted. I think the criminality of it not coming out is sort of twofold, in the sense, like, do you remember with Seiken Densetsu 3, with Secret of Mana 2, you know, everybody, it was criminal that wasn't brought out simply because they didn't see that it would be feasible. And you know, Secret of Mana was fantastic because you could do, if you had a multi-tap, you do that three-player action RPG that, you know, really, I can't think of anything that's really been like that in that style since. And I feel the same way when it comes to Mother 3. It's like, it is such a unique style of RPG. And I think that sort of plays to the fact that it is criminal that it wasn't brought out, because you know, Nintendo, for all the good and bad or anything else like that, you know, whatever you might think their faults are, games that they usually get behind are always unique. There's always something unique about them, even if they're taking, you know, regular tropes from different genres and really kind of adjusting them and putting that Nintendo spin. And, you know, and then on the other hand, they've written the book on so many things, you know, and this feels like one of those things that feels like a missed opportunity. You remember how it felt when you played either the first Earthbound or when you played Super Mario RPG and you were like, I can't believe this concept works, but it does. And not only does it work, it works extremely well. That's the way that Mother 3 feels to me. And I feel like that's kind of where the criminality of it comes in, because it is such a good game. I cannot fathom why they wouldn't have brought it out. Even now, when you have these people, there's a pent up, if you look at forums and everything else like that, there's a pent up demand for retro gaming. Look at the indie scene right now. It's all 8-bit and 16-bit clones. Like, they could produce something like that, just translate it, and they could make some money off of it just putting it out, because people want to play stuff like this. Yeah. And it is a shame that it hasn't come out just for that reason. But at least we're not like it was back in the day where, you know, if you couldn't play it, you couldn't play it. At least we have options now.
Yeah. You know, part of the reason the Mother series, the Mother trilogy, is so unique as far as gaming goes, has a lot to do with its creator, its designer, Shigesato Itoi. Itoi is a truly unique individual. He's kind of like a Renaissance man, and he's done a bunch of different stuff outside of gaming. You know, he used to be a copywriter. He started writing books and essays, and he was a singer and songwriter for a while. He was an actor. In fact, he the voice actor for the professor character in My Neighbor Totoro.
Wow.
Yeah, but he specifically designed the mother game so that it would sort of have the feeling of a bunch of, you know, just a bunch of kids out in the yard just playing pretend. You know, that's why the enemies are all so weird and random, like evil trash can and evil stop sign and evil random person on the street.
Huh.
Yeah, there's exactly. There's a certain, particularly with Earthbound, I'm not that deep into Mother 3 yet. I mean, there's definitely that kind of stuff there. But, yeah, like, you know, he really kind of built the series around what he called reckless wildness. And that's how, and so basically what he would do is he'd go to his staff, and they would just try to figure out different ways of doing different scenes in video games and trying to make them interesting. Like Earthbound feels very much like a 1950s, like, era America where people weren't, but then just like you run into stupid stuff like the evil trash cans, the aliens, all that stuff. Like there is, The overall signature of the game, the underlying logic behind it, the language is completely unique. And that's carried into Mother 3. And there's really not any other games out there that are like it. And I think it comes from, you know, to Brandon's point, the creator's background is so incredibly diverse. I think he edits a news site now.
He actually has a blog, and he's one of the most popular bloggers in Japan. He has a website and everything, and he does a bunch of other stuff too still, but yeah, he's a cultural figure in Japan. And funny enough, in Japan, although Mother is popular, it's considered to be just sort of one part of his overall oeuvre as an entertainer and creator. But
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Other thing about the Mother games is they sort of have that feeling of like an early 80s, like Spielberg sci-fi movie or like The Goonies or something like that.
Kind of.
You know, Stand By Me, that type of thing. But
yeah,
the thing is,
it's interesting. It's almost like an injection of Americana in a way that you would not expect from you. You know, you would expect from. I think that's actually really fair. Yeah, the kind of a Spielberg type feel to it. Yeah, I definitely think that's accurate. And it's so interesting to see that coming from a Japanese developer who obviously didn't grow up in America. To capture that is really interesting.
I mean, the freaking Blues Brothers are in Earthbound, even though they don't call them the Blues Brothers. But also, the Mother games, by the third act, they get really, really dark. Like dramatically dark. Yeah. And that's especially true of Mother 3.
Don't ruin it. I'm still playing, damn it.
Yeah. So that's a lot of good stuff there.
Cool.
So we got a new release coming out Tuesday.
Yeah, there are probably other releases, but the only one that Pat and I didn't really care about is Project Cars.
Not very often that a viable competitor comes out to Forza Motorsport and Gran Turismo, so, and this one looks to be exactly that by all indications from reviews, from the footage we've seen. This one's the real deal, and that, you know, as far as I can remember, has never happened before.
Yeah, and definitely not multi-platform either. And it's interesting to see from Slightly Mad, because when they released Need for Speed Shift, you could kind of get the hint that there was something there, that this studio was capable of doing more. And trying to fit into the Need for Speed franchise, I think, kind of hurt them initially.
I think that hurts lots of games, but...
Well, that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, that's my just personal standpoint.
Yeah,
floating to the surface.
Yeah, but I'm all for, you know, another competitor in the sim racing genre, especially that one that a lot more people are gonna be able to get their hands on.
Yeah, it's kind of structured differently too. I think I read somewhere there wasn't going to be like a progression system in the traditional sense. It just lays everything out for you from the beginning and lets you explore it on your own. Well, something else that jumped out at me, there was a trailer that kind of highlighted some of the courses that'll be in the game. And you got some of your standbys, Laguna Seca, Brands Hatch, Monza. Imola's there, that's cool. Donington. Yeah. California State Highway 1.
And for those of you who don't know, California State Highway Run goes all along the west coast of California.
Yeah.
Literally along the coast. It is the scenic route.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which pretty much, legitimizes what a lot of people in their supercars tend to do on California Route 1. Kind of treat it as a racetrack. I seem to remember someone in Koenigsegg got a ridiculous speeding ticket on Route 1 at one point. I think he was doing 222.
He's lucky he didn't wrap it around a street sign.
Yeah.
Hell, he's lucky he didn't lift off.
Yeah. Well, you're not going to lift off in a Koenigsegg.
No, the down faster forks. You go,
you have a better chance of getting crushed by the downforce.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm sure it's going to be on our now playing list next week.
Yeah, I think we're both definitely going to be playing it. I don't know about Brandon or Lee or Teresa, but at least two of us will be playing it.
I swear we just covered all I'm going to be doing is playing my GBA.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about Final Fantasy XV last week, but something that I thought was worth revisiting was an article that Games Radar wrote about kind of the narrative, the cast of Final Fantasy XV, and how it might be an evolutionary step forward for how characters are portrayed in gaming in general moving forward.
Yeah. So I went through and had a look at some of the footage for Final Fantasy XV that you had captured a while back, so I could get a sense of what we were talking about.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can kind of see the author's point on this. The relationship between the characters it's definitely interesting. It's not a typical bromance type story. It just seems like a bunch of friends, which is you don't really see all that much.
And you also get the impression that Ignis is the only reason that the rest of them have survived this long.
Yeah. Yeah, considering...
He cooks for them.
Yeah, basically does everything.
Yeah. But it's definitely an effective cast of characters from what I've seen. Mm-hmm. The game itself needs to be better, but... if Tabata achieves what he claims to be setting out to do, obviously we've seen similar evolutionary steps in other mediums over the last 10 years or so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I
guess what I want to say is with all this talk about inclusivity and being fair to women in gaming and all of that. Tabata is basically saying, and yeah, he had a pretty bad way of saying it, that there are other
the translation too.
Yeah, that there are other things that we kind of need to address as well. The big guys with bad attitudes and the occasional romance type storyline kind of has to stop because I'm getting sick of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he's setting out to disassemble that as thoroughly and, with as much extreme prejudice as possible.
Well, hold on. While that may be true, the fact, at least as far as I see it, is that Final Fantasy really up, I think it's going since 4, maybe 3. I can't remember. I haven't played 3 in forever. But 4 going onward has always had female characters, and they've always been strong. So I don't necessarily believe you know, that this is something where it's like this guy's being a misogynist or something else like that. But for a series that has consistently had strong females and strong female leads to all of a sudden not have it. And then to kind of be, it is jarring. And then to have him go, well, we need to address other things. Like, come on, man. What the fuck kind of political ass answer is that? Like, you're not a politician. You make games. Just own it. Don't sit here and be like, oh, well, I think we should address other things. If you didn't want girls in your game or whatever, just say it. Or if you couldn't come up with a concept of a female that would gel in your game, then just say it. Don't deflect. That's chicken shit.
Well, it's kind of like, why can't Luke and Han and Chewie go off and have an adventure in the Millennium Falcon? Leia doesn't have to go along all the time. Sometimes she does not want to go.
Yeah. There's that.
Yeah, exactly. And it can be framed that way. Like, you know what? These are just guys. They're out doing whatever. You know, it's bowling night for them or you know, whatever. Like, but
that's bowling night gone horribly wrong.
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly. But like, just own it. That I think that's what bothered me about it when I saw it, is it really just felt like a really wishy-washy answer from a company that we've seen, I think, make strides over the last few years to actually try to be tuned in to what their fan base wants. This seems like an incredibly stupid landmine to step on. When there's, you know, just like what Teresa said, you know, Luke and Han can go get drunk by themselves, you know. It doesn't – you can talk about this in different ways instead of being like, well, we need to address everything else. Like, that's not how progress works in any way, shape, or form. So – and if he didn't want to be part of the conversation, that's the kind of answer he should have given instead of what he actually said.
Yeah. Well, part of me wonders if it's not a case of lost in translation.
Yeah.
It could be. Could be.
Like the approachability comment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the something that, you know, this company really should watch out for. I mean, at this point, I feel like what they did, the turnaround and stuff like that they did with Final Fantasy XIV, was their consumer base showing them goodwill.
Yeah.
Square Enix burned a ton of bridges with everyone with Final Fantasy XIII. So they really, and especially in the current industry, the way it is with people kind of being like hyper aware when it comes to inclusivity and everything else like that, God really should watch that. Just for the reason of you don't want to alienate potential customers because, you know, the message that you're putting out is, well, this is a boys club. Like, come on, man.
Yeah. Well, then again, that's, you know, not really what he's saying, you know, that this is a boys' club. This is more, you know, just a bunch of dudes who happen to be together, you know. But
I'm sure someone could infer something else from that. But
now.
Yeah. Well,
this is Japan, and one guy so there's is going to be a lot of shonenai and yaoi material. So don't worry about that.
Yeah, we'll wait for the fanfic authors to start picking that up a couple of months after release. So.
I was going to say, I do think the one interesting thing that has been cool with the whole Final Fantasy demo is that they basically went back and they were like, tell us what you like, tell us what you didn't. Square has always before this just made their games in a vacuum. So with the exception of Final Fantasy XIV. So if this is kind of the route that they're going, I think that's actually really fantastic. I think the big thing they'll have to deal with is how they sort that information and really how they process it. Because, like, you know, again, I play MMOs, and MMO community can be so toxic. The feedback that they give usually is not very good. It's usually just, oh, you took away this thing I liked. Fuck you.
Hate.
Yeah, hate. You ruined this game for me. I will never buy another thing from you. And then meanwhile, they're subbed for the next 4 years. So, you know, I do think it's cool to have a big company like Square where they had that work. Now coming back to do that for their single player stuff. I think that's really cool. And it's safe in a lot of ways because to go back to what I said a minute ago, they know they burn bridges with their fans with 13. So the fact that they're coming to the fans and basically going, tell us not how to screw this up, is cool.
Yeah.
I think my feedback on the 15 demo would have been a little more cynical than some of what Tabata got. But going back to the original point, I think if it can be an evolutionary narrative that kind of deconstructs the sort of faux machismo character types that currently plague the industry, I'm all for it. I hope the game behind it is worth playing at the end of the day to actually, you know, get that value out of it. But still kind of residing in my own cynical place, I'm already kind of looking past Final Fantasy 15 to 16, just based on the powers that be at Square Enix now and what's already been established for the future direction of the company.
Yeah. Well, it looks like they're, you know, trying to make a go of 15. I mean, they're doing everything they can to at least, you know, fix this game to make it something that's not completely broken and horrible.
Yeah. So,
you know.
And you never know, it might completely surprise us.
Yeah.
I would love to be pleasantly surprised by it. Yeah.
There's still a lot of time left between now and release, so.
Like I still say if it comes out anything like the demo was, I can't see putting up with 40 to 60 hours of that. But I want this game to be good. Square Enix is doing so much right at this point. They need a proper single-player numbered Final Fantasy game to be a success story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, sticking with the JRPG topic for just a minute, Tom Lipschultz over at Exceed Games says that even though the translation's done, the editing's done, Trails in the Sky SC is still months out. It's in QA, which is going to be grueling for a game of this size. But soon enough, it will be convenient to start measuring it in weeks rather than months.
And one person on this podcast is avidly counting the days.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think it sounds... All right, to me, it sounds like they're getting ready to announce a release date at E3, which would make perfect sense.
Yeah, which would be about a month out, so they'd have another, you know, month of QA time, and at that point they'd probably know where they stand.
Yeah. And yeah, and QA for a game of this size, once again, cannot be understated, so hopefully it still makes summer. I'd like to see that. But I don't know, I've long since figured out that doesn't always go that way when you're talking about localizations of games with a script the size of SC.
Yeah.
So,
But it's definitely something to watch, and I still I've been playing the Japanese version a bit on my PS3 some more, and I can't wait to get my hands on the translation. It'll be great.
Yeah. Well, at least it'll give you some time to, you know, start nailing down those last few percentage points.
Yeah, it's true. I still need to do that. Problem is, once I do that on the PC version, I'm going to go back and do it on the PSTV. This is a great game, a great series, and it's definitely worth replaying. And you know, I could recommend it to just about anybody.
Yeah, cool. Next, we'll move on to Sony is doesn't really want to wait to announce Project Morpheus.
Nope. Swedish show coming up here in about a week and a half. Nordic Game 2015. All indications are that they're going to kind of establish the basics of the hardware for Project Morpheus at the show. It's kind of consistent with what we've seen with consoles themselves in recent years. Find a show or hold one yourself to unveil the hardware, get the introduction out of the way so that, you know, once E3 rolls around, it can be all about cramming games into your eyeballs. A little more literally this time around.
Yeah. And that, and that's a problem for, you know, a show like E3, especially on a keynote. You can't really get the picture quite well unless you've got the goggles on your eyeballs.
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of want to do it off on a side event and, you know, get the introductions out of the way and have the units on the show floor so people can go check it out, get hyped, and then let them do your evangelizing for you.
Yeah, and I'm sure that'll happen.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if we see some kind of adapted trailers, B-rolls, things like that to just to give the world an idea of what's coming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the next couple of years is going to be pretty huge for VR.
It'll define VR, really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've got Morpheus, we've got Oculus Rift, which is going to be in the first quarter of 2016. Vive, which is apparently going to be at the end of this year. So, you know, if you want a VR helmet, you're going to have a lot of choices.
Yeah. To rephrase what you just said, a little more bluntly, this time next year we will have consumer VR for the gaming market in our hands and on our heads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll be there.
Yeah.
So.
Now, can you imagine a virtual E3?
Wow. I can imagine it.
The technical hurdles to overcome to make something like that happen.
It's a question of the ambition of the event organizers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it would be possible.
Yeah.
But
looks like sooner,
they
closer,
want to bring
closer.
The experience home that badly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like we're getting closer and closer to the world from Ernest Cline's Ready Player One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to be in that world.
Well, the virtual world, not so much the real world.
Yeah,
the real world kind of sucks.
Let's not live in the stacks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would very much like to explore, you know, Zork.
Yeah.
Oh my.
In a virtual
God.
Instead of, you know, in the
space.
Yeah.
Yeah, listeners, if you haven't read Ready Player One, it is great. Patrick, come on.
We really need to make just a whole cast one of these days just about
this
book.
This is all taking place over a Skype conversation, but I can't avoid the feeling that I'm being stared at by everyone here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this wouldn't Look really be life. Unprecedented either for Sony.
Despite my inconspicuous silence.
Because if you remember a couple of years back on the PS3, in PlayStation Home, they actually had a reproduction of their E3 booth.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ooh. Now, on that scale, I could see them doing it.
Hmm.
But what I couldn't picture was, like, the ESA getting together and simulating the entire event in one, in a single VR simulation. There'd have to be, you know, Sony's version of it and Microsoft's version of it. I could see that happening.
Yeah. Somebody's going to do it. There's going to be at least one smaller conference that's going to take this on and show that it could be done at scale. And at that point, the floodgates will just be open.
And hopefully the collaboration would actually play out that way.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
Hmm. Yeah. We are excited about VR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we want Patrick to read Ready Player One. So get on it.
I've got an Audible credit. I'll send it to you.
Okay.
It's read by
Will Wheaton.
Yeah. So
that has to be good.
No, it's good.
Oh, why didn't I listen to it? Why did I read it?
Yeah.
Pat, by the way, if your local library has My Media Mall and Overdrive, that kind of thing, you can borrow it for free. You may have to wait a couple of weeks for it to become available. But at least you can get it for free. That's how I did it.
Hmm.
Borrowed it on my Kindle for free.
Hmm.
Nice. Oh, something is going on. I'm hearing myself echo.
Yeah, I think that's through Brandon's speakers, but that's okay.
Well, I got mine turned down.
Hmm.
It might be me.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Okay.
God, get it together, Teresa.
Yeah,
Jesus.
I can't hear it now.
Yeah, we're okay.
Yeah.
Ah, damn it, Apple.
Congratulations, you got it together.
All right, so the Street Fighter V projections came out from Capcom recently. Surprisingly reasonable.
This fiscal year?
2 million copies for the fiscal year 2015. Well, 2016.
Very doable. That
seems doable for a number. Words are hard. For a numbered Street Fighter sequel.
Yeah, they've got their feet on the ground. If Street Fighter 4 is any indication, I don't see why Street Fighter 5 would have any trouble pulling those kind of numbers.
Yeah. I mean, Street Fighter 4 sold like crazy when it came out. So,
yeah. And we've talked about this on the show before, but Capcom has long wanted to turn Street Fighter into a sort of social platform. If they succeed there, then 2 million copies is nothing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that 2 million copies, period, or 2 million physical copies? Or
2 million copies entirely between PC and PS4.
Yeah. Oh, well, they'll have no problem.
Yeah, they'll turn that no problem. But it's just nice to see more realistic expectations rather than a company coming out and saying, if we don't pull 5 million, 6 million sales, then this is an abject failure, and we will never again revisit this franchise as long as I'm in charge of this company.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's good they're being realistic about it. And I do think there's that pent-up demand, especially for anything next-gen right now. But you even look at like what happened with Bloodborne. I mean, they were elated, 1 million copies. Like, I think last generation, something of like Street Fighter's caliber, they wouldn't say 2 million. They'd said 6 or something like that. So it's good that they're trying to be realistic. But I wonder if part of that is also coming from the fact that it seems like Sony is bankrolling it. Because, Sony was also involved with Bloodborne. So Sony might be really championing those, $3 million copy sellers as a really big deal, as opposed to, we didn't sell a hojillion copies, therefore we're closing the company, firing everyone, and killing their dogs.
That's only a slight exaggeration.
That's what EA does, right? I think that's part of the severance package at EA.
Set the house on fire, castrate all the children, and then put the rest of the family in a gulag in Siberia somewhere.
Oh my god, you guys.
See, that's definitely Activision.
Yeah. Oh dear.
Wow.
Guys, you gotta have somebody working on those fixes on Destiny. So,
going back to the top of the show, I promise we don't hate AAA.
We don't.
Sometimes this comes out and there's no stopping it.
I can't help it. I'll go for the joke every time.
Yeah. You have to understand, we all grew up at a time when there was no major internet in the gaming industry. I mean, the internet was just becoming a thing for a lot of us when we were kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And 500,000 sales was considered really good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. As sane companies, it still is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Square Enix. Bravely Default pulled 400,000 copies in North America and Europe, and that changed the entire direction of the company.
Yeah.
400 million.
God, then they would probably it'd probably still be a flop. Yeah.
Remember in our day, if you wanted to go
rich
get
as fuck.
Yeah. Don't forget in our generation when we wanted to go get tips or codes or something, we had to go to the grocery store and go over to the magazine aisle and get, EGM or GamePro or something and copy it down in a notebook.
Wasn't that a blast though?
Yeah,
it kind of was.
If not, just have photocopy the thing at Kinko's. But
there's not even.
I still remember being in middle school and people having photocopied text move lists for characters in the fighting games we happened to be playing at the time.
Yeah,
selling them for like $5 or $6 a piece.
Yeah.
Yep. We were swapping assholes. Magazines back and forth for whatever game we happen to be playing.
Yeah.
I do kind of miss all of those old magazines, though.
Yeah, you may miss some, but your allergies don't. You know how much dust is in those things?
Yeah.
By now?
By now, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, oh God.
As opposed to the organic internet.
Yeah. Speaking of which, of our generation, I had a friend of mine was going through some of his old stuff recently. Remember those old Tiger Electronic games? LCD ones, they were shit, but...
Yeah, I tried to block some of my memory of those out, but yeah, I do.
Yeah, all those things were freaking everywhere, yeah, and I had the...
They were cheap.
They were cheap pieces of garbage, but they convinced us somehow that you'd have a great gaming experience for just $20.
And that's one thing that has changed in the past few years is now you can get a great gaming experience for $20.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh,
you don't have to pay. Yeah, don't have to pay out the ass for an SNES cartridge.
Yeah.
So, just on that topic, real quick, you know how everybody's always just like, "Oh my god!" Like, game. Like, if you go on forums or anywhere else like that, you can see. People being like, should games cost more and da 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 da. I don't want to get into that argument, but I just want to point out, just as a random thought, since we're talking about when we grew up, do you remember when controllers were $20?
Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
Man, that was sweet.
It was. Yeah.
That was sweet.
Yeah, it's kind of flip-flop now. Now they're making money on controllers, and the cost of games really hasn't gone up that much. Yeah, I do remember, like, back in the day.
They've come down a little.
Yeah, they've come down a little. Well, it hasn't really gone up all that much.
Well, no, I do remember Super when NES, I bought... Super NES, N64, talking $80 a game sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, but that was all media. I didn't want to go... We don't have to go down that road, guys. Just controllers. Yeah, 15 controllers. Or 20 bucks.
Yeah.
That was sweet.
Yeah. And it was for, you know, actual OEM controllers, not like third party.
Yeah. The reason I'm saying that is because I've been on this retro kick, and some motherfuckers on eBay want $50 for a Super Nintendo controller.
Shit.
Yeah, they think they didn't know better.
Yeah.
Shit. Look, I was alive when these things cost what they should have cost.
Yeah.
I get scarcity of demand, but that's the other good thing. At least the old Nintendo controllers. I mean, I still have one of my original SNES controllers. Which I think at this point is old enough to drink.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
It probably still works, too.
It still works, yeah. It's unbelievable. It's a little dusty, but I just really wanted to touch on the fact that I missed $20 controllers.
Yeah, so do I.
That was nice.
Man, it was sweet.
Yeah, and speaking of our generation, John Romero has had something to say recently about the whole modding incident that Valve had.
Interesting revelation.
John Romero shouldn't say anything about money. I'm sorry. Not after Daikatana, not after he was renting out a penthouse for his... So they're the top floor of like, was it the Chase building or something in Dallas for like $1 million a month? Like,
yeah.
His point may be sound, but to me, having John Romero talk about anything financial would be like asking a bank robber what you should invest in.
Well,
it'd be sort of like giving MC Hammer a show on, you know, Fox Business or something. It just,
I would actually watch Fox Business if they put MC Hammer on a show.
Okay.
Maybe.
That's a little musical inside joke. You have to remember, MC Hammer basically pissed away all of his money on frivolous shit. So,
yeah. And then he tried to make another album for fairly recently, and that didn't.
He's
go
too
so well.
too legit to invest.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, his point was that he thinks modders should, you know, make money off of their creations, and they actually had plans to actually try something like this in the early 90s, before Quake came out, but the whole plan got shelved because they were in such, such a crazy situation in that game's development.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with them though. I do think modders, if I wouldn't have an issue if they had a like pay what you want model. Like I don't think, at least it's been my experience with the modding community, people don't mod with the intention of making money. And the other they might do it with the intention of getting getting attention, you know, having something that they could put on their resume, getting developers to take a look at them, stuff like that. You know, it can be looked at as sort of like advertising. And, you know, the mods, especially when you look at something like Skyrim, can go from just, you know, we're going to stick Randy Savage's head on a dragon and have it yell, "Oh yeah," instead of breathe fire, to, you know, completely separate, like mini, like complete full side quests, almost like expansions. Yeah. I think having a model where you could pay what you want would work. But I think the other thing that all of these people that are saying, you know, modders should be paid, I think the thing that they're not covering is that, at least for me, the minute I put down money on something, I expect it to work. Yeah. So if I get a mod where I put down money for it and it's just kind of janky or whatever, fine. It didn't cost me a dime. Yeah. But if I'm paying 10 or 15 bucks to have this thing do something and then it won't, I feel like that's a huge problem. And like, I think that was part of the reason why you saw Valve do what they did as far as, you know, trying to put something out there so modders could make a buck. But they also screwed up by the fact that I think at the end between them and Bethesda, they were taking 75% off of doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's unacceptable.
And
yeah,
it's completely unacceptable. I mean, it is unacceptable. There's nothing else to say about that. But I would wonder if we truly get into like this paying for mods thing. Because, you know, Valve doesn't give you your money back for anything, like at least not in America. You can buy a game in Europe and get your money back. But over here in America, digital distribution is you bought it, you're stuck with it. And it's hard enough even with games that are AAA, like when you saw what Ubisoft did with Assassin's Creed and 343 did with Master Chief Collection. These are huge companies with hundreds of millions of dollars behind them, thousands of employees that could actually get this stuff right and then didn't do so in those instances. I don't know that John Smith from down the street that wants to put nipples on everybody's armor is going to have the ability to satisfy his customers or anything else like that, offer support. And particularly that's not going to happen through Valve. So I would not be comfortable paying a modder unless it was like, you know, pay what you want. And not to be cheap or something like that. That's not why I'm saying it. You know, if they delivered like a quality product, that would be something where I'd want to give them money that I felt was reflective of the effort that they put in. But at the same time, that also opens the doorway for you paying for completely broken shit in a system like Steam where you have absolutely no recourse. Because like if you do a chargeback or something on your credit card with Steam, they just close your account.
Yeah.
So you have absolutely no way. It's literally 100% buyer beware. And that doesn't sit right with me. And I feel like at least for people like me, until they figure out a way to tackle that or even have like – because who's to say – like look at what happened with Steam Greenlight where and Early Access where people were just putting up absolutely broken shit and asking people to pay for it. This is that same thing but with an even smaller component of a game that you're paying for.
Yeah.
And I don't like the idea of that, of my money being tied into something that no one is even going to guarantee would work.
Yeah. Yeah. Mistakes were made. There's no doubt about that in this case.
Yeah, to play devil's advocate, though, I would say that to that first part about modders not doing this with the expectations of being paid, I wonder if a pay system was properly implemented, how many potential modders that would add to the community out there. You know, people who might be more motivated to get into modding if there's some money to be had or existing modders who might be convinced to put more time and more effort into, you know, more detailed or just deeper mods to games if they thought that there was you know, potential line of income to be had from it.
No, I think there's definitely some of that. But, you know, the system that Valve proposed just didn't allow for anything.
75% is a non-starter anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I think if you got past that, implement some kind of moderation system or some kind of community, community accountability.
Yeah.
For the non-functioning pieces of shit that Lee describes, I think it could work, and I'd like to see it happen. To be honest,
yeah, I would absolutely, you know, shell out some money for Skywind.
Oh yeah,
and if you know, not familiar with that, what that is, that's the recreation of the entirety of Morrowind inside of Skyrim.
I heard about that. So you get the world of Morrowind in a playable game.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
Skywind. There's also Skyblivion that's being worked on as well.
See, now that's something worth paying for, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all a matter of scale, you know?
I'd pay for that Randy Savage mod, too.
No, I wouldn't pay for that.
Maybe with Skyblivion, when they say that, you know, you're going to have this great army behind you, it's not going to be just four or five dudes running down a hill.
Yeah. In weirder news, PT is the ongoing saga of PT has been pulled from PSN completely.
Yep.
Yeah, we're beyond the point of abject failure, PR disaster. This is something completely different from all that.
This is the type of shit that Joseph Stalin would pull when he wanted people to just disappear.
Well,
do everything you can to erase their memory.
They're certainly disappearing it.
It feels like a scorned girlfriend thing. Like they're like, fuck Kojima. We're gonna do everything we can to erase him. Although I think it probably has more to do with royalties, and I think to lead into, you know, what we were going to talk about next, Pat, like I know that on people have been selling PS4s on eBay that had PT loaded, and Konami is getting eBay to take those down.
Yeah.
And I feel like all of this has to be because, like, because PT was on PS Plus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the amount of copies.
It was just on PlayStation Network.
Yeah, it was
a PS Plus game because I have it and I know I didn't buy it.
It was free.
It's free. Okay.
Yeah.
I wondered if down the line, if those downloads and then sales together would have translated into some sort of royalties for Kojima. That's why this almost feels like spiteful to me. Of course, it's completely hyperbolic. I don't know if that's the case, but I've never seen a company like Sony didn't go after people that were selling backwards compatible PlayStation 3s when they brought out the slim PS3. Like this really feels like personal, doesn't it?
Yeah. Something else is definitely going on here.
I mean, it's been said before, you know, the CEO of Konami hates Kojima's guts. So
yeah, there's some bad blood going on here somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's a real shame too, because PT was is probably one of the, even though it's just a playable trailer, it is undoubtedly one of the best horror games ever made.
Yeah, there was a lot of potential there, and we're not going to get to see it. So.
I mean, it was a genuinely unsettling experience.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
there's
a talking fetus and a sink.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Jeez.
No, there is definitely that.
Yeah.
For my part, you guys know me. I've never really been one for the horror genre, but I'm kind of invested in this now, just because of the stakes that have been presented. I sincerely hope that getting content pulled from PlayStation Network isn't as simple as just going to Sony and asking, at least getting content pulled to the degree that PT has been. Because the status quo up to this point has been, yeah, sometimes a game will lose its licensing for whatever reason, and they'll have to you know, stop selling it. But as long as it's been sitting there on your account, you can re-download it as many times as you need to, provided you've already paid for it and it's already registered to you.
Yeah, I think this is a first, to be
honest. This is something altogether different, and I don't like the implications one bit. Just as a consumer, as a PSN member.
Yeah.
At this point, Konami might as well just burn down their HQ and get the insurance money.
It might very well be leading to that, by all indications.
You guys ever think maybe like the hospitals and stuff inside Silent Hill are actually just Konami headquarters with the lights turned off?
Probably.
Yeah. That would explain a lot.
Yeah.
Although that would also explain, why did they have a young teenage nurse in there?
Beats me.
Japan?
Yeah.
We'll just go with that.
Yeah. Because Japan. Yeah. Anyway. This is another installment in the ongoing PT saga. I'm pretty sure by next week we'll have more to say on it.
Yeah, more developments, something.
Yeah.
This sucks, though, because this is like Del Toro's third video game project that's gone under.
Is he cursed or something?
I don't know.
Wow. So, more Amiibo news. Nintendo. And it begins. Nintendo reiterating that they didn't really have very high forecasts set for Amiibo. Once again, apologizing for availability failures, but not in a way that...
Okay, you know what? No, what the problem is that they apologized, but they didn't say what they were going to do about it. Like, we all know that Nintendo is a...
quote-unquote better communication.
Yeah, but what does that mean? What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. That's the thing. That's a canned PR response.
It could mean a very bad thing the way I'm thinking about it.
Well, it's what they're saying to try and placate a group of people that they're not serving properly. Like, I don't know how often or how regular you guys frequent NeoGAF. The Amiibo threads in that place are insane. Like, it's just pages of people like, oh God, yeah, I tried to get this, couldn't. God damn it. Like, over and over and over and over again, people are super upset about the only people that seem to be happy are the people in Japan and some people in Europe. Like, I remember there was something like, I think it was 10 or 12 pages long where people were flipping out because the Amazon pre-orders for one of the waves hadn't gone up, but they had gone up like at every other Amazon except for Amazon USA. And like,
that's kind of funny, actually.
Yeah, like, but this whole better communicate, that doesn't mean anything. Like, so what are you going to say? Oh, well, this is going to be rare. We already fucking know that. That's why you can't buy them now. Like, oh God, I'm so.
You know what I'd like it to be? I'd like it to be them making the mistake of communicating openly on their own website what stores will have what figures when.
Yeah.
So instead of getting 30 guys camped out around a store, you'll get 300.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Nintendo historically will not this works to their advantage because, like we have talked about on previous podcasts, the demand is there. They know it's there. Anyone that knows how to fucking read would have known that the demand was there. This is literally as stupid as Atlanta's mayor, or excuse me, Georgia's governor, when we had that snowstorm like 2 years ago, go on the news afterwards and be like, I didn't know a storm was coming. And he had an iPhone in his hand. And even Al Roker was like, are you, what? How did you, what is wrong with you? Like, that's the same thing here. These guys acting like we had no idea after the first wave that this stuff was actually going to sell well. Come on, son. Come on, son. Like, and, God, just makes me mad thinking about it because all they're doing is they're even for the amount of people that they're getting to buy into this stuff, the amount of people that they're alienating because of it is exponentially larger, and they will not They will not say stuff about reprinting figures or anything else like that, because that drives the demand down now, because it creates the idea to consumers that if I don't get this now, I could probably still get it later. And that's not going to make them any money.
Well, they've already talked about reprinting several figures.
Right. But do you know when this is going to happen?
Nope.
Do you know where it's going to happen?
Nope.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you get people, you create the demand where people are like, I got to buy this now because I might not be able to buy it later. And so that happens is instead of a person getting one or two figures, they're going to go to the store or pre-order or sit up at 3 o'clock in the morning and try to pre-order from Toys R Us or Best Buy every single one that they can get. So Nintendo converts, for those types of people, converts a sale that may have been $12 or $13 to $65, $70, or any amount higher that these people can get. Yeah. And I cannot help but feel that they're doing that willingly. Because
I wouldn't be surprised.
As many figures as they've produced, they have to be getting sell-through numbers. They have to be getting something. And what I think we're on what wave 5 or wave 6, you know, and we know they're going to keep going. So they have a good idea about this, but they're not going to be candid. They're not going to come forward and say, hey, I know everybody's looking for a Marth. That's going to get reprinted. I know everybody's looking for a Ness. That's going to get reprinted. They're not going to do that, because then that takes away from people who go to a store and see something and go, oh, wow, I got to get all of these. They're not going to do that until the sales finally crash or go down. And then they'll come out and go, hey, you know all those figures you guys missed? We're going to reprint them now. And then just get people right back in the same cycle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And conversely, you got people like me who folded from minute one just for that very reason.
Yeah, I have two for my son for his birthday, and yeah. I felt dirty buying them.
God, being a Nintendo fan really is like being in an abusive relationship, isn't it?
Well, it pisses me off, because if this part of it didn't exist, I'd probably have a shelf full of them, because Nintendo is a company that I feel like, regardless of some of the stupid shit that they do, I still feel as a whole is very beneficial to the industry that they're around.
Yeah.
I can't say I've ever bought a Nintendo product, like a game, and felt ripped off. I can't say that about any other company that I've purchased anything from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's so frustrating when you watch the course of everything that they've been through over the last few years. It's almost like they're actively telling people not to give them money. And now they're finally getting into like trying to get an account system, the stuff with DNA, and looking at doing something with mobile that's going to be beneficial to them. But it's happening now, because if Nintendo is a ship, it's on fire and it's sinking. You know, they're finally getting to the point where they can correct things, because their audience, like we were when we were kids and we were playing Game Boys and everything else like that, that audience has moved on. They're playing Minecraft and everything else like that. The people that are supporting Nintendo now are the diehards. That's why the Wii U has sold so little and doesn't have mass appeal. The group that they appeal to with the Wii and with the DS moved on to mobile. And so at least they're doing the right thing in that sense of trying to get that group's attention by doing something on mobile. I don't think that they should go full mobile. I still like having handheld systems and everything else like that. But this would have been something that would have been great for them to do 3 years ago. The Amiibo stuff would have been the same thing. And then when they finally do it, they fuck it up. And it's so frustrating to me as a fan of that company to see them do this stuff and then to be ignorant about it. Like, oh, we didn't know. Okay, fine. You might not have known the first two times. But if we're on wave 5 and you're still underproducing, at that point I can only deduce that you're doing so because you want to take advantage of the people that want to buy your products. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Not to go on a rant. Yeah. You kiss my ass.
Too late.
No, I'm going to have to get a
turn this into a rant here.
I'm going to have to get a bumper for Lee's rants.
It's like, really?
Go all Molly Wood on the...
Anyway, it sucks to see them do this. And it's not like they don't have a history of this. They did this during the NES. And pretty much every time that they could corner the market in a certain way, they've always done this stuff. Yeah. But it doesn't make it any less shitty.
Yep.
Especially when we have an industry, I feel like in a lot of ways would – rob the client or rob the customer if they could. Not developers, but specifically I think publishers tend to do that. I think like stuff like the Arkham Origins or Arkham Knight DLC is horse shit. Like I so many of the practices that the industry has gotten into to try and make more money have really come off as scummy. And Nintendo, I felt like this generation didn't do that until now. Because there's no alternative for the DLC that the Amiibos provide. That's the other problem. But whatever, that's a whole different story. Sorry, I'll stop.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, well, we might as well move on to something a little bit more cheery with Project Soul.
Yeah, they've kind of been quiet of late. Launched a free to play single player game on PSN.
Yeah, that didn't go so good.
A while back.
Yeah, kind of blew.
Now they seem to be setting up for something a little more ambitious. They've got a character popularity poll going on Facebook right now, and they straight up claim to be planning something huge, whatever that might be.
Well, next gen caliber wouldn't be unwanted in my book.
Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of Soul Calibur 5, but I definitely was a fan of some other past installments of the series. So, more Soul Calibur being on the way is definitely something I can look forward to.
Yeah.
You know, as long as it is a proper, you know, as long as it's not a single player free to play, you know.
No, they've already made that mistake, so hopefully they won't do that again.
But a proper fighting game with, you know, something more along the lines of 2 or 4, I could really get into.
Yeah.
Also, make sure that, you know, Ivy's breast physics act like actual human boobs and not like balloons tied to a broom.
Yeah, but why else would you play the game?
You know, it's funny. Ivy is considered to be like the epitome of the over-sexualized fighting game character that's a female, yet nobody remembers Sophia from Battle Arena Toshinden, who was straight up a Russian dominatrix with a whip.
Yeah.
Because that's because of the graphics. Toshinden, like now, I don't think you could actually tell what the characters were supposed to be.
Yeah.
They rendered that today.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of my guilty pleasure fighting game. I really don't think Toshinden got its due.
It really didn't. No. I actually really enjoyed the first one. That waterfall, son. That waterfall.
Yeah.
Yeah. First two were pretty good. The third one, I'm not entirely sure what happened there, but we'll not discuss that one.
That was to relegate itself to the exclusive development of hentai puzzle games.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been brilliant at that. I have no doubt about that.
Oh, prolific, if nothing else, I suppose.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll hear something almost. And I think Lee wants to talk about World of Warcraft.
No, I'm gonna. There's a big backlash. Blizzard lost 3 million subscribers since they launched their new expansion. I actually want to look into it more before I talk about it. I have my own ideas about certain things, but I just don't want to run off at the mouth. But I feel like their big change, like, and I'll discuss this more in depth. Like I said, I know you guys don't really do MMOs, but the core component of the expansion was this thing called Garrisons, which was basically like a Facebook game. You ever play those Facebook games where you send people off to do missions?
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what the garrison mechanic is. And then you can put things in your garrison, like a farm, or you can have a mine, and then you can go get crafting materials from those. And what was interesting, and I feel like is a, just based on some of the stuff that I've read, a big reason that a lot of people were dropping was that this expansion of Warlords of Draenor was supposed to be a return to form for Blizzard. When they launched it, they went from having, I think, 7.1 million subscribers back up to 10 million. And because it was just like, this is like, because for a lot of people, the golden era for World of Warcraft was the first expansion, Burning Crusade.
Wrath of the Lich King.
No, no. Oh. Wrath of Lich King was the second, which is my favorite. But Burning Crusade was loved by so many people because it did a. Looking back at it now, a lot of it was kind of like head-bangingly irritating, but there was such a large breadth of content that you could really go off and do a lot of things. And people were still on that high where, like, this game is amazing. There's all these things to do, all these things to explore. What else can I do? What else can I get into? And, like, the WoW community is not like that now. But they lost 3 million subscribers in 7 months.
That's huge.
It's huge. It's basically a third, a little under a third of their populace. So, and you know, subs come and go with MMOs, people run out of content to do and things like that. But this expansion was so light on so much of its content. Like, the core of it was this garrisons mechanic, which I was just talking about. But the other thing was, is that you had the developers, like, one of the things that started happening after Wrath of the Lich King came out is you started to be able to fly. Like, Burning Crusade introduced flying mounts, and you could fly out in Outland. And then when Wrath of the Lich King came out, you were able to fly in Northrend. Then they came out with Cataclysm, and they redesigned the original 1-60 vanilla WoW world so you could fly in it. Mists of Pandaria came out, you could fly in it. And then for Warlords, they set it up to where you can't fly. And their reason for that they said officially on the forums was, we don't want people to just kind of fly over the content in the world that we took time making. We want them to be in it. We want them to be active. We want them to be engaged. And that's really interesting that they said that, because the garrison is an instance area where you're sitting by yourself. And the main and the core component, if you're not raiding, is really doing garrison stuff. So you're essentially sitting in your garrison with a bunch of NPCs with nobody else around, sending out work orders.
How wonderful.
How does that get you into the world? How does that make it more immersive? Like, that is the beginning of, I think, the reason why they lost so many people. Because, like, the leveling experience in the new expansion is phenomenal. It's probably the best it's ever been. But after you're done with that, you're playing a glorified Facebook game if you're not raiding. And it's one of those things like, well, this is what we wanted to accomplish, and this is what actually fucking happened. And it strikes me as one of those things like, how could you not see this coming? Because, like, there was a farm mechanic in the previous expansion, Mists of Pandaria, but it wasn't a core game component. You could do it if you wanted to. It let you get resources. It had some dailies attached to it and things like that. And they it's like they took that concept and they said, let's just make this the cornerstone of the expansion. And I don't know why they would have done that, because – and I think based on the bleed that you've seen from subs, because that was the major component of the content besides the raids, like the two raids that they've released haven't even been that interesting. So Blizzard seems to kind of be stuck in this cycle where they know what they're doing is causing them to lose subs. They know they have to produce more content and they have to do it faster. Like, but they yet every single time they don't do it. There was between Wrath of the Lich King and Cataclysm, I think it was a 12-month gap in content. Between Cataclysm and Mists of Pandaria, there was about a 12-month gap in content. And then from Mists of Pandaria to Warlords of Draenor, it was, I believe, 14 months. And I think what it's done is it's also created a culture around the people that play these games where they don't stay subbed because of that. And I wonder if this kind of thing continues to happen, because we shouldn't downplay the fact that 7 million is a lot. Like, even though they lost 3 million, they lost more customers than pretty much every other MMO has out there combined. So just to keep the numbers, you know, in check. But at the same time, you have to wonder, like, Blizzard is a company that has always made fantastic games. And even with their stumbles, like, WoW is still a fantastic game. It's just that this expansion wasn't very good. But it wasn't good because there wasn't enough to do. And it seems like for them, almost in a way, they're falling into the same cycle that a lot of these other AAA developers are, where it seems to be costing more time and more money and more man hours to produce less and less and less. But then they're also asking for more money for it. And I'm curious if this bleed continues, what that does, because you've seen Blizzard, you know, they're branching out. We have Hearthstone. They're working on Heroes of the Storm. Overwatch is coming out. They're going to close out StarCraft with Legacy of the Void. They're obviously branching out, whereas before they were very narrow. But I'm curious how that company is going to evolve in the next few years if this massive amount of money from WoW starts to slowly bleed away. And especially because, you know, they're lined up with Activision and everything else like that. This subscriber loss and the money from that is going to have some interesting outward effects that aren't going to be readily available. But what's crazier to me is that I don't think Blizzard is going to change their design philosophy that caused these people to leave in the first place. And I think that's really interesting because I would not have suspected Blizzard in the past would have done something like this. Like, they seem very keyed into their audience, and this is an obvious strikeout. And I don't know how they could have come to this conclusion to do the things that they did and then bleed the people that they did. I'm really curious to see where they're going to go now. Like I said, there's some more stuff I want to read about it, but that's the core of what they have going on. I'm really interested in the financial portion of it because, again, even if all 3 million of those people, because they do get some of their subscribers from Asia, and those people pay a different model than we do, but that's still a lot of people. Just think about that. 3 million people. We were just talking earlier in the podcast about how if Street Fighter got 2 or 3 million sales, they would say that's awesome. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
These guys just lost more subscribers than most games ever sell.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, that with and that alteration 3 million, of their bottom line is huge.
That's 3 million times how much a month?
It's
$15 a month, but not everybody pays that way. Like the Asian market, I think they buy credit where they get so many hours. But even still, when you look at it that way, it's still money that was coming in, and it's
that
not.
That might come out even more money then. And
yeah.
Considering some.
And it's an interesting contrast as well because, like, Star Wars has a very large cash market. They have cartel coins and stuff like that. Final Fantasy 14 and WoW also have that, but the percentage compared to every other MMO is tiny. Like, I think WoW has maybe – I apologize. I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I could be wildly inaccurate. But I believe they maybe have 15 to 20 things on their cash shop, whereas, like, because of Star Wars free-to-play model, they're every week – there's an update to the cartel market that has or every few weeks there's an update to the cartel market that has armor sets that have to be bought with cartel coins. Someone is spending real money to get these cartel coins, and then they can put that stuff up on the auction house in the game, and then people can pay credits for them. But at some point for those items, someone is paying cash for them in some way, shape, or form. And that's the backbone of how that game works. WoW and Final Fantasy don't work that way. And with the MMO genre kind of going the way that it is, WoW's sort of been the titan in all of this. Like, I think Final Fantasy has 500,000 subscribers, maybe 750. Whereas WoW had 10 million and just lost 3 million. So you, like, imagine the financial planning where they're expecting those additional 3 million, you know, customers for just one quarter. Imagine how many projects that funds. And to just have that evaporate, that's crazy. I'm like I said, I'm really curious to see how this stuff will go. But I honestly am a little disillusioned with Blizzard. I don't think they're actually going to listen to their customer base. I think if they were going to, like, you guys, again, I know you're not MMO players, but the forums revolted over them removing Flight and not having it available in Draenor. Because what happens is when you get a high level character, you don't want to fuck with all the stuff on the ground.
Yeah.
You don't want to have to do, you want it to be easier. That's the reason you leveled. You got all the cool gear. You want it to be easier when you're going out in the world to get this one thing that you need. And to have the player base be accustomed to that since like 2006, and then to just take it away because you want to immerse them, but then you have their main thing that they do, have them sit in an instant zone where they don't see anybody anyway and don't go out in the world.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if they put Jay Wilson on the World of Warcraft project. At this point.
No, the guy they have working on, his name is it's Ian. I'm probably butchering his name. I think it's Hazakostas. Mm-hmm. And Blizzard has really talented people, and yeah. I've always kind of felt like they were a company that didn't really get screwed with when it came to the bottom line because they had such a pedigree. that they could really kind of do what they want. But like, this is going to be, realistically, this is going to be the second market that's starting to kind of fall out from under them. StarCraft, the original, is still played. It is a pillar of the type of esports community that so many other places want to, or so many other games want to build. And that audience, in the same way that we talked earlier about, you know, Nintendo, like, kids have moved on from Nintendo games to doing Minecraft and mobile, and those consumers that Nintendo captured are playing stuff on their mobile when they used to play stuff on their DSs. A lot of people that I know, and this is anecdotal, but I think the numbers also back it up, people have moved away from real-time strategy games and are going towards MOBAs. So Blizzard has sort of lost the bottom on that market as well, and now it's starting to slip in the MMO genre. That's why they're making Heroes of the Storm, because they're trying to stay in that groove and stay relevant and kind of deal with the pricing model that gaming is moving towards, at least in that PC space. So they're essentially losing two of their three pillars, because Diablo is still doing okay, but imagine if that goes under, or if something, you know, that type of game gets replaced with something else that they can't charge a $60 box for. I mean, their whole way of doing business evaporates.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested to see what they do now, because they're obviously trying to rebuild. That's why they did Hearthstone. That's why they're doing Heroes of the Storm. But it's going to be interesting to see where they go from here, because, again, 3 million people. My God, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it kind of is. But at the end of the day, they basically... they had their initial subscriber bump from the expansion, and then they lost it all. So they kind of ended up breaking even.
They ended up where they were before, exactly. So, you know, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens now, because, you know, it's got to also be really difficult for them. Like we talked earlier about how do you take that data from your client base and actually turn it into something that you want. I mean, this is a company that basically ignored everything that their customer base wanted when it came to Diablo 3. And even then, everybody still bought that game. I mean, I remember reading stuff where people were like, I played this game for 80 hours, and it's terrible. why did you play it for 80 hours? But that it doesn't also change the fact that they were right. Like, as soon as they got rid of Jay Wilson, and they came in and they said, you know, with this patch 2.0, we're going to fundamentally change how this game works. They essentially made that game what it should have been at launch.
Yep.
And I'm getting that feeling now with Warlords of Draenor. I halfway expect whatever their next expansion to be a complete reversal of all of the mistakes they made with Warlords that caused them to lose those 3 million people. But I think the difference here is, since there's a pay component, those people probably won't come back.
Yeah. If they want to do it, they're probably going to have to put out some sort of major patch and not wait for an expansion if they want to.
Right. And it doesn't look like they're going to. I mean, right now they have patch 6.2 coming out. Like patch 6. So typically their patch cycle, they always put out content with every single patch. And really the 6.1 patch was them really adding the stuff that they said was going to be in the expansion when it launched. So they're going to be doing a new raid for 6.2. But there's not been anything else about what's coming after that. Whereas the Mists of Pandaria cycle was 5.1, 5.2, 5.3, and 5.4. There was actually criticism that they didn't give the patches enough time for people to consume the content because they had so much and they shot it out so rapid fire. That was a thing that people complained about with Mists of Pandaria. Like, I was just getting into the patch content of 5.1 and you put out 5.2. Now that's the exact opposite. People are like, this is it?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where they go, because I'm not going to say they're in trouble. Good Lord, they still make, you know, a hojillion dollars a month, but they're obviously trying to pivot because they see this coming. But at the same time, WoW is their biggest moneymaker. It could be the easiest one to essentially write the course with. I don't know how they missed it.
Well, you know what's something I would love Blizzard to see do?
Was that?
Anybody remember that game Blackthorn?
Yes.
I'd love to see them bring that franchise back.
Yeah.
Because that was a solid cinematic platformer.
Yeah, I'd be on board for that.
Yeah. I think Blackthorn is actually playable in Heroes of the Storm, by the way.
Yeah, and so are the Lost Vikings.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's a Facebook group that I belong to, and it's for moms who game, and we had a pretty good discussion going about the 3 million drop at for WoW. And over half of the moms, I know this is just anecdotal, but over half the moms who responded, they said, yeah, I left. I went to Final Fantasy 14.
Yep.
That's so, a pretty good reason to leave WoW.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I know Final Fantasy 14 is a good game, but 3 million of them didn't leave because that game only has like 500,000 or 750,000 subscribers. And it's also fighting the fact that it's almost 11 years old. Like, that's...
Yeah.
That's something else, too. Like, you know, it does have that working against it. But I wonder if those people that left, I think they might be the kind that, like in the Nintendo example, that don't come back.
Yeah, it's very possible.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Well, I'm going to be beating that discussion into the ground.
Well, that's a good discussion.
I'll have your update next week.
All right. We'll wait for that. So I'm guessing that's a show for this week.
Now, one thing I want to add before we sign off, with us being on iTunes and coming to other aggregators, definitely leave your ratings, leave your feedback. If we get some reviews, we might go over some of them on the podcast next week. But we definitely
tell me how much my
you all think.
Yes, tell me how much my accent annoys you.
Yeah, we definitely
tell me to... I stutter too much.
Yeah, tell me I talk too much and I'm too angry.
All right.
Well, that's what makes the podcast.
Yeah. All right, well, with that, I'm Filippo D'Onofrio.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm Lee Lamb.
And I'm Teresa Sammons.
And we'll see y'all next week.